Hello, everybody. Welcome. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on collection letters in the time of coronavirus. Empathy, even more than usual, is the name of the game in the collections world today. So many people have been affected by COVID-19, from people who've tested positive to those who have lost their jobs. Regulators are taking much closer looks at the actions of debt collectors, and in some cases, making decisions that impact how collectors are communicating with individuals. In this webinar, we've got a panel of leading collection industry executives who are here to share their insights to help companies in the industry adapt their letters to the current socioeconomic climate. Adjusting the tone and composition of letters can make an incredibly big difference, to a company's operation and to its future. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Dennis Barton is the owner of the Barton Law Group in St. Louis, Missouri, which specializes in collection and defense services for members of the ARM industry. His firm represents collection agencies and creditors filing collection lawsuits in the states of Missouri and Illinois, and also provides letter review services, consulting on compliance best practices, and defends agencies against consumer lawsuits nationwide. He graduated from the Indiana University School of Business in 1996 and Washington University School of Law in 2003. He is the past president of the Missouri Collectors Association, as well as the ACA State Compliance Chair for the state of Missouri since 2017. LaDonna Bowling is the Chief Compliance Officer with Receivable Solutions Incorporated. She has more than 20 years of operational and compliance experience in third-party debt collections and experience in all verticals serving creditors and debt buyers. LaDonna is a certified instructor for ACA International and was named one of the 25 most influential women in collections by Collections Advisor Magazine in 2016. She was also named Who's Who in Compliance in 2018 and the ACA International Certified Instructor of the Year in 2019. Alicia McKeegan is the Chief Compliance Officer at AFNI Incorporated. She's been in the industry for more than 10 years and has experience building and enhancing AFNI's compliance management system. She also has experience with FDCPA, TCPA, and FCRA litigation and regulatory licensing. She's a member of the ACA Federal Affairs Committee and holds a Credit and Collection Compliance Officer designation with ACA International. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel or send it to us through the chat module. This event is being recorded and recording will be made available in the coming days on AccountsRecovery.net. Finally, I want to ask everyone to reserve a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after today's webinar is over. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Your participation, your feedback helps me develop content that is what you're looking for and make sure I'm finding the speakers like the ones we have today where the people you need to be hearing from. With that, let's launch into our discussion today. And first, let's go around the panel and get a sense for whether or not the panel is still sending collection letters and get a sense of whether the volume of letters they are sending is the same as before the pandemic struck. We'll go alphabetically. So Dennis, we'll start with you.
Well, hi there. I'm a collection attorney. So just like every other collection attorney, I send out validation notices. We don't send out letters after that. We just file suit and move on. But we also have some other letters that talk about the status of your garnishment and how much you still owe. But we haven't changed any of those letters. We haven't increased or decreased the volume. We haven't changed the language to, be COVID-19 related. As the discussion goes on, we'll kind of talk about why and why you should or shouldn't. But for right now, we're sending out letters just like we normally would. And in fact, with clients that aren't suing, because in some states like Illinois, where you can file, but they're not going to serve them, and for cost reasons, clients don't want to file, we're still sending out validation notices to keep the collection process moving.
We're still sending letters as well. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yep.
We're still sending letters as well. Our process is when an account comes in, we automatically mail the validation notice, and then the account is on hold for 30 days, no activity. So we've not really decreased the volume on sending out the validation notices. We have decreased sending out final notices because, you know, the tone of those letters are a little bit heavier than the validation notices. So we've, you know, modified it to an extent. What about you, Alicia?
We're still sending out collection notices. We've had about, I would say, 17% decrease in what we normally send out. The real odd thing about kind of when COVID hit is it's right on the tail of tax season. So comparing kind of overall volume to what we were sending out, you know, the first couple of weeks of March into February to now isn't really a fair comparison because we were right at the tail end of tax season. But in terms of just normal decrease, we've had about a 17% reduction. And we haven't really seen, you know, much drop off beyond that. We haven't received as many new placements as we normally would get. We have a lot of clients that are holding placements or that are saying, you know, we're still going to send accounts to you, but please do not notice them. We just want to keep the flow going. So we have decreased initial notices, and I think that accounts for most of that reduction that we're seeing.
Yeah, it's been hard to track it with tax season and everything and comparing it to same time last year or same time last month. And so we've been trying to track our incoming, but it's a little hard.
You know, Alicia, it's interesting you mentioned that some of your clients are asking you to hold off. I'm having the exact opposite response from my collection agency clients, my first party creditor clients. They're all saying, push, push, push. Not to do anything illegal or be rude or anything like that, but to not stop the process just because there's a crisis. For Missouri, which is has continued to be a great state without a lot of regulations outside of the FDCPA, of course, you know, we're still filing suit. We're not having hearings, but we're still garnishing and still collecting garnishments. And so, you know, those clients want to go, go, go. And in Illinois, even I've had clients, as far as letters are concerned, they want to keep pushing those and then file suit as quickly as we can once service issues are resolved.
So you're a pushy guy, Dennis.
More of my clients than me.
So if you are still roughly sending out the same volume of letters that you have in the past, I'm curious what the response rate is to your letters and how that compares to, I'll say, BC, meaning before coronavirus. You know, are you collecting more via letters than you have in the past? This time we'll start with you, LaDonna.
We saw a 4% lift in March, but I don't know if that's because of COVID-19 or because of tax season. The beginning of March was heavier with payments than the end of March. We saw a little tail off, but things picked up in April with payments and such. Like I say, we don't do any activity on account for the first 30 days. You know, we send that letter and the accounts just kind of sit there. So we do like to track the payments and the contacts off of the letters. And we've seen a little bit of lift in that, but I can't say that it's for COVID-19 and people are at home, but we are getting a lot of call-ins.
And you don't track where the call, you know, it's not necessary to track. It's not, can you track where the call-ins are coming from?
If they're calling
after they got a letter or not?
Yeah, and we get most of those calls typically around day 25 after the letter goes off. We've not seen any change in that. They'll start trickling in, you know, once the letter goes out, and then they really pick up, you know, around day 25 or so after the letter was sent, and then they continue, I want to say, for another 10 or 15 days, and then most of our contacts are because we're outreaching with phone calls.
Got it. What's been your experience at AFNI, Alicia?
So kind of similar to what LaDonna's comment was earlier, it's been kind of hard to track this particular one. I have a really good business intelligence team here, and our business analyst tells me that typically we don't track in this short of a period, and probably for the reasons that LaDonna was saying in terms of responses being at day 25. And so they normally limit it to like a 60-day mark in terms of responsiveness. So He said it's really too early to tell in terms of, you know, our letter campaigns that were going out and kind of how it's hitting in the midst of the COVID crisis.
How much more of a runway do you think do you need before you can maybe sort of get some guidance or some clarity on the impact?
Probably another couple weeks, and we'll know. He provided me some information on comparison to last year. Mm-hmm. And we're showing a pretty significant lift, but we don't know if that's letter campaigns or people being at home, or if it's, you know, the stimulus money that's coming in. We're assuming and attributing it a lot to the stimulus money, but in terms of the effectiveness of campaigns, we can't make a to B connection.
Yeah.
Got it.
And we're not asking for the stimulus money. Just want to put that out there.
What about you, Dennis?
Well, we don't really get a lot of feedback from validation notices. I attribute most of that because we're not putting the name of the law firm on the letter. And I'm sure agencies, you know, have that same struggle where had you been able to tell people who the letter's from, sometimes they'll avoid it even more, but sometimes they want to open it and respond. So we don't get a lot of response there. I have gotten a lot more incoming calls, though, as I hear that's pretty consistent with a lot of other people. So maybe it's from the letter, maybe it's not, but I think it's more just from people who already knew they had issues that you know, my firm was dealing with. They wanted to reach out and resolve things. But from the letter, I don't think it's because of the letter.
Are either one of y'all changing the content, the wording of your letters?
Go ahead, Alicia.
Yeah, so we haven't really made that modification. You know, from a compliance perspective, anytime we're talking about changing wording on letters, I get really concerned. Number one, because it's class actionable, and also because plaintiff attorneys are, you know, so predatory as it relates to letters. So we haven't changed anything on our letters. What we have done, though, is we put a disclosure on our website. So all of our letters refer to AFNEycollections.com, and when a consumer logs into their account on the AFNEY Collections website, there is a disclosure that basically says, you know, we acknowledge that during COVID, you know, things are a little bit different and we're here to help and call us and have a conversation. So that's the only verbiage we've changed to address COVID specifically. We haven't modified anything on our letters. How about you, LaDonna?
Yeah, same thing. And I'm glad that you confirmed, kind of validated me, because I tend to be a little conservative, you know, with letters and such, because it's such a hot spot for lawsuits. And then just to change the verbiage on your letter, you know, it's a long process. You got to work it out. Then you got to get somebody like Dennis or John Bedard to look at your letter and see if it's okay. And then once they say it's good to go, your letter vendor, they have to get the changes. And then there's all this back and forth. And I just figured by the time, you know, we were done with all those heavy processes with that heavy lifting, it wouldn't be necessary anymore. At least that's what I was hoping.
Well, Don, I agree with you. I think either John or I should review those letters, and I think excellent tip to the audience. One thing, you know, so I do letter review, and it is, you know, I've always, you've probably heard a lot of people say, have your letters reviewed, blah, blah, blah. You know, yeah. And the small, relatively small amount of money you pay to have them reviewed outweighs even one lawsuit, individual, let alone class. But, you know, now is even better time to have them reviewed. Maybe things are a little slower than usual, and get those letters reviewed, especially if you're going to change them. And I don't mean that to be self-serving. You really do need to have them reviewed. I love Alicia's point about plaintiff's attorneys, those consumer attorneys. You know, we always focus on us, and we're making, you know, maybe less money and, you know, more hardship on us. And, you know, and there is, and that's legitimate. But I think the consumer attorneys are facing the same thing, right? They probably have their own set of issues, and they're looking to make some more money, and they're looking to offset their expenses associated with COVID-19 crisis. And letters are so easy. They're easy to get certified. They're just easy from a plaintiff standpoint. So don't, you know, you don't want to overcorrect and add a bunch of stuff in your letters, get some collection law, get, you know, get a big lawsuit. And so make sure you have them reviewed. You know, as far as changes go, I don't think you should change your validation notice at all. validation notices are the grounds for most of the lawsuits, or at least a lot of lawsuits. And so I wouldn't tinker with those at all. If you've had them reviewed by an attorney, if you haven't, definitely do that. But if you have, leave them be. And I was talking with Bobby Blue over at Rentcom, and I just asked him, you know, we work together a lot, and I do letter review for a lot of his clients. And I said, what are your clients doing about changing their letters? And Bobby said a few different things. Some of them are doing a whole special letter, one or two letter series on, we're here for you, and we know it's tough, and, you know, here's some, you know, we're open to give you special deals. And then some of them are doing there's a regular letter, no changes at all, except one little line maybe at the end or maybe toward the beginning, one little line about the COVID-19 crisis and how, you know, we can appreciate the extra struggle. And from a reviewer standpoint, it's probably, you know, more cost effective to do it that way. But even if you just add one line, I'm telling you, because these cases are so easy to bring, have somebody review them.
Isn't that a cool name, though? Bobby Blue. He sounds like he's the lead guitarist in a blues band. But I agree with everything Dennis said, and it's always good to be on a panel like this with such esteemed folks like Alicia and Dennis, who know what they're talking about. So I feel pretty good about what we're doing, you know, not changing letters and such.
Hey, one other comment I wanted to make on the changing the letters. I talked to Aaron Ryder over at Interpros. And I said, you know, from a technology standpoint, from a collection software standpoint, you know, what are you seeing? What are the issues that agencies should consider when thinking about changing their letters? And he brought up the difference between legacy systems and newer modern platforms where, when you do a changing your letter, you got to change the template, not only in your system, but also your letter vendor system. And the change in the template with more of a legacy, an older system with older technology, can be more expensive because you might have to have a programmer come in and change those programs. Whereas a legacy software or a legacy platform, it's a lot more user-friendly. It's a lot easier to do. So cost is less of an issue. So I guess the larger point is the older your system, the more cost you may have to incur. And in talking with Roger Weiss about this issue, he said costs are going to be one of the driving factors in his mind as to whether to change, and if so, to what extent to change. So, there's all these factors where we're talking about letter vendors and your software and making sure that, you remember the factor of cost as well as compliance when deciding whether or not to move forward.
I'm curious if the duration of the pandemic is going to lead to anybody to sort of change their mind about either frequency or content of letters. I mean, if this doesn't end in the, if this goes on for more months and more months, do you foresee more people making changes, or do you think that the compliance regulations and the litigation risks just are too great to try and to do that no matter how many or how long this goes on for?
I say the risk would be too great, regardless of how long this goes on for. If you have a letter, it's been validated by an attorney, and they say your wording is good, and you've had very little activity from a demand or legal perspective from attorneys wanting to sue you, you know, don't mess with it. Keep it the way it is, because, you know, the language has been proven. It's been signed off on as saying it's good language. You're good to go with this letter. You know, why rock the boat?
And I agree with LaDonna. I think, you know, one of the things that LaDonna, you mentioned earlier, is the amount of time that it takes to change a letter in order to do it correctly. So I will say, you know, there are some agencies that maybe, pending the risk, were considering making modifications and then thought, okay, well, we have this risk and there's a time associated with it that it's going to take to change. So now that the pandemic is continuing longer than we thought, you know, now we may have the time to have this properly vetted and evaluated. And let's not also forget those state regulators that need to review changes to letters. And so
yes,
we haven't made any modifications to the letters currently, but I don't know, you know, for Nevada and Maine, how quickly that turnaround time would be for those regulators to review the modifications. Now, of course, if you're collecting regionally and you're not subject to, you know, those specific states, then that's not a consideration. But I do think that should be kept in mind as well. If you're going to make modifications, you have all of these different hoops you have to jump through, and then you have the state regulators that need to approve them as well. So, you know, kind of my thoughts are no, we would stay the course and not change unless we had some type of regulation that we thought we needed to address. And I'll give you a for example. So when North Carolina came out, we did have a discussion about, well, do we go ahead and put some type of disclosure on deferment of payment on all of our North Carolina letters? And we ended up with, no, we're not going to add that. You know, we're going to modify our scripts for our agents, you know, make sure that they understand that anytime we're discussing anything with a North Carolina resident, they're proactively offering that, but we're not going to change anything on our letters. So that being said, if there's, you know, more guidance, as it's been put so far, that comes out from regulators, you know, that may be something that we hadn't considered that would cause us to modify. But for right now, we're going to stay the course and not change anything, regardless of how long the pandemic lasts.
Yeah, because we know the states don't always respond quickly. And like, I think it's Wyoming, their board only meets once a quarter. So if you don't get your changes then before the most current board meeting, you got to wait another 90 days. So
we have a question that's come in. So I'm going to use this as an opportunity to remind everybody, if you have a question for our panel, type it into the Q&A box or the chat module and we'll get it asked. Also, if you are one of the ones who have changed your letters, if you have any experiences you want to share, type it in and I'll be sure to mention it. We can put it up for discussion in front of the panel. The question that's come in is...
Mike, I'm sorry, yep. Before you ask a question, I'd like to make a quick comment on the North Carolina.
Of course.
Alicia's comment. So in North Carolina, I think this is what Alicia was getting at, is you don't have to make a disclosure. And so they decided not to. You know, if you're asked about, you know, making accommodations, you can ask for accommodation, you know, you can offer those accommodations, but you don't have to come out with in letters and do that. And, you know, I'm going to watch two things. First, watch for states that start to require those as time goes on. But my recommendation is to not go out there and start affirmatively suggesting things if the state, you know, if a statute doesn't require it. It's another thing where you could get sued for maybe not disclosing it enough or not disclosing it properly. And now you're getting sued for disclosing something you didn't have to do in the first place. So I think that's wise of Alicia not to do that. Okay. Sorry, Mike, go ahead with the question.
It's okay. But it, now you've led me to ask a question. I mean, obviously, you know, as everybody listening, and I'm sure the three of you can attest to, a plaintiff's attorney or an eager consumer will sue for anything. Do you foresee lawsuits coming because that disclosure wasn't made or because, you know, the letter content wasn't changed to reflect the times of the day? And if so, I mean, is there, I guess, you know, it's maybe there isn't anything that can be done about it, but I'm just wondering if you see that on the horizon possibly.
I do, and I kind of think of it in the same way I think of the trend in litigation relating to out-of-state debt. You know, there are now all these courts and these circuit court cases are saying that it used to be that unless you threatened litigation, you didn't have to disclose that the debt you're seeking to collect was out of statute. And then it went from, if you said the word settlement, well, that's close enough, and so now you have to disclose. But now it's, a lot of courts are saying, if you're attempting to collect out-of-stat debt at all, you have to disclose that. It's, you know, there's different disclosures depending on what the laws of the underlying state are, but for the most part, you have to disclose that it's, you know, it's out of statute and you can't sue. And it, you know, and if the law, state law says this, the partial payment will restart the clock. I mean, I only bring that up as an example because the law doesn't say that. Nobody says that, and yet courts drain this stuff up. And this is maybe another instance where disclosure and a disclosure obligation is thrust upon us by courts who are maybe trying to be well-intended or whatever, overly consumer-friendly, thrust upon us an obligation. That doesn't mean we should react now and start preparing for it, but could we get sued? Yeah, will we? Probably. And it's just going to be one of those things we got to figure out when we do.
I agree. They're going to try us, I think, and come with different angles and look for opportunities wherever they can.
Yeah, agreed. I think it's, you know, it's always a moving target when it comes to letter language. I think, you know, the only thing that you can do as an agency is stand your ground in terms of your defense strategy as it relates to letters. Get good attorneys. Make sure that you're not an easy target. I mean, if it's not the pandemic, it's going to be validation language. It's going to be your out-of-stat disclosures. It's going to be, you know, the fact that you included settlement in your letter instead of discounted payment offer. So there's always language that is going to be at issue, and you just have to make sure your defense strategy is solid so that you're not an easy target for the plaintiff attorney.
Now, Alicia, you said good attorney. Is there such a thing?
Well, I happen to know one named Dennis. I'm not sure about the rest. Yeah.
You know, Alicia, one of the things you mentioned, I like the way you think in that I call it low-hanging fruit. Make sure you do the easy stuff. Get your letters reviewed, because it's super inexpensive relative to the amount of money you could lose even with one suit. That's an easy one. Make sure you're not, if you're going to have a disclosure within a letter, like I said, make sure it's reviewed first. Make sure you're training your people on stuff they can and can't say on the phone. You know, do the stuff you're already supposed to be doing independent of a COVID-19 crisis. And especially the areas where you know lawyers, especially in your area where you know where they like the kind of stuff they like to sue on and what they like to bait call on, make sure your people are aware of that. It's that low-hanging fruit that's easier to train for and expect, because there's some stuff we're not going to know. I mean, some plaintiff's theories are going to come out of this and they're going to hit us and we're going to have to pay big bucks because we didn't see it coming. And that's, you know, we'll have to adjust when it happens. But some things we know about, some cases we know are going to be filed. So let's try to adjust to the extent we know.
Now, Dennis, do you think, I mean, what is the best plan for sending letters? Because, you know, the FTCPA says we have to send it within 5 days of our initial communication with the consumer. And a lot of shops, you know, like the one that I'm at now, we send that letter as soon as we get the account. So do you think that it would be, you know, a risk mitigation just to wait and send that letter when you make that communication, or, you know, go back and look at your numbers and see what you're getting off of those letters? I mean, what do you think?
Well, my personal opinion is I like to send it out of the gate. For example, lawyers, we can file a lawsuit without sending a letter. A lawsuit is not considered a contact. It's not a communication. Right. So I can file a lawsuit and wait to see somebody in court or way down the road, but I don't. I send a validation notice right out of the gate because I don't want to mess up at all. I don't want to forget. I don't want to have any glitch in the system. I even know most people don't even read these things or respond to them, but I still send it just to make sure. Now, you know, from a collection agency standpoint, I know that the two philosophies that I've seen are the one I just talked about. You just send it out, boom, done. And you wait to get a first party contact. And the other one is you don't send it to get a first party contact over the phone, because until you get that, you don't know for sure what the address is. And I view this less as a compliance issue and more from a cost standpoint, because it's more costly to send out a letter before you verified the address. But from a compliance standpoint, cost excluded, which is not a real thing, by the way, everything is cost included. You send out the letter automatically. That way you don't miss anything. But I think both strategies are valid, and it's just a cost issue. Did that answer your question, LaDonna?
It did. You know, like I say, I'm more conservative. Anytime I can mitigate some risk, I'm all there. You know, I don't run ops anymore, so I don't worry about the cost.
Sure. Alicia, what do you do?
We do a little bit of both. It really just depends on the client and our strategy, if we're credit reporting or not. For a long time, we did a lot of just initial noticing without contact. We changed that up in previous years just to see, you know, from an effectiveness standpoint and a cost, letter cost. And my audit team heavily monitors the controls associated with the sending within contact to ensure that, you know, our system controls are in place and we're sending it out when we're supposed to and that there aren't any holes. So, we do a little bit of both. I think that overall, you know, the cost of compliance and the auditing associated with our strategy where it's first notice on contact isn't more than, you know, if we were to continue to just send all notices initially when we get placements. So just depends on the client and our particular strategy at that time.
So what's the goal on sending the letter other than, you know, satisfying some legal requirements? You know, what are we hoping? You know, consumer just mail in a payment or they contact us? You know, what's the goal? Dennis?
So,
or Alicia?
Well, I was saying,
go ahead, Dennis.
No, Alicia, you go.
Thank you. Our goal, and this is what we teach our collectors from day one, is just to, it's to achieve resolution of the account. So our goal is always to just have a conversation with the consumer. You know, we certainly don't want somebody who's been subject to identity theft or anyone that has a valid dispute to call to just mail a payment back to us because they just want to be done with it. You know, we want to do the right thing by the consumer and by our clients. And so, you know, some of that is helping them understand, you know, what may have resulted with this account. And so, you know, if you talk to ops, it's just respond with the payment. We just want the payment. But I mean, our company's philosophy in general is we just want to resolve the account, whichever way that occurs, hopefully with payment. But we just want to have a conversation. So I would say the goal with our letters is just to get to resolution.
From a collection attorney standpoint, it's just, it's a box check. I mean, I wish we didn't have to send them. Nobody, you know, very few people respond. Some people do, but not very many. I just need to file the suit and move on with it because the creditor already tried to get the money. The agency already tried to letter it and call it to death. I mean, by the time it gets to me, letters are not very effective. So it's a compliance issue. It's something we have to do, so we do it.
So how do you think it's going to impact us from an industry perspective, the states that have stopped the collection process pretty much, you know, from debt collectors calling, and then our clients that aren't placing accounts. So now these accounts are sitting there and they're aging. And, you know, how do you think, what do you think the future looks like for us there, you know, based on the COVID-19, you know, epidemic, pandemic, and now we're getting accounts that were usually considered primes and they might be 6 months old now or 9 months old and, you know, we're trying to collect on them. And do you foresee a lot of bankruptcies? You know, what do y'all think is going to happen?
Go ahead, Alicia.
Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to be polite and go ahead.
No. So we, thank you, Dennis. So yeah, we're definitely expecting more bankruptcies. In fact, there's been, you know, some suggestions by, probably one of our favorite people in the industry to make the cost of bankruptcy a little bit cheaper for consumers right now, just because it's an option. It's an unfortunate option for a lot of consumers right now. I don't know what's going to happen with the delays. You know, at AFNI, we deal with a lot of later stage debt, a lot of out of statute debt. So I think, you know, one of the things that agencies need to be prepared for, maybe that aren't already well versed in that particular area, is, you know, controls and proper risk mitigation strategies around working some of that older debt and aged placements. I think the other thing that's going to be interesting is that when we quote turn spigots on, is it going to be all at once? And so, you know, are these consumers that have now had, you know, deferments and payments held off and collections that have not gone to collection agencies now going to get overwhelmed? It's a good question, LaDon. I don't have a good answer other than, you know, if you're an agency that's not typically used to that type of debt or that age, you really need to get well-versed on the compliance requirements and the risks associated with it.
You know, I was going to say before Dennis jumps back in, scrubs. I think that if you're not scrubbing for, you know, bankruptcy now or even litigious debtors, you need to go ahead and get into the groove of scrubbing. And then, you know, with credit reporting, you know, holding off credit reporting and such. And one of the biggest areas I see with some of the predatory attorneys is, you know, usually, you know, what they're famous for is bankruptcy, and the consumer goes to them for bankruptcy, and then they start their spiel with, you know, is this on your credit? Are you being contacted by a collection agency? I see a lot of them coming after that, especially if bankruptcy filings increase and, you know, those types of issues. Dennis?
Well, that's great insight. You're exactly right. You go to the bankruptcy attorney who turns you over to a consumer attorney. That's excellent. No, but that's really good insight, LaDonna. There will be an increase of suits due to that. You also make a good point about needing to scrub for bankruptcy before you do anything. And from a practical standpoint, before we issue garnishments, we scrub for employment again. Right at when this thing hit, and I knew we weren't going to be able to go to court very often and get new judgments because the live on the civil side anyway, the live hearings are done, or at least they were put on pause. I scrubbed every dormant account I had for jobs to send out garnishments, and I don't know if that's going to end up being a wise decision or not. I mean, it's my money; it's not the client's money. But we got a ton of hits. But by the time we get the garnishments out there, I don't know who's actually still going to have that job. I think it's all going to offset to where. I mean, I think it's still going to be more money than not. But it's I'm going to have wasted a lot of good hits because those good hits a month ago were no longer good hits now. They don't have a job anymore. An interesting thing with garnishments is that for people working at home, these companies, you can still serve them with garnishments, but you got to be careful because sometimes they're only at the location on certain days and certain time periods. So our office not only calls to verify the person's still employed, but to verify someone's going to physically be at the address because although in Illinois, when you used to be able to do garnishments, you could do it by certified mail. In Missouri, the sheriff has to serve them and has to serve a live person at the location. So you've got to double check that. So to the extent that sort of scenario is happening where you are, just double check everything. So we also had a question about changing the call strategy or increasing the amount of calls to get first contacts. I don't think my clients are doing that, but that's more of a question for you two. What do you guys, are you changing how often you call or changing the first call to get a better first contact? LaDonna?
I don't want to say anything on the grounds that it might incriminate my company. But there have been some adjustments in the outbound, dialing strategies and such. So there's been a lot of more attention paid to some particular accounts, and we've come up with a status to remove accounts, take them out of the general population if we talk to the consumer and they've been laid off as a result of the COVID-19 and such, and those accounts just kind of go into a holding pattern until the smoke clears, so to speak. So yeah, we've made some adjustments. Alicia, what about y'all?
Yeah, we've certainly made adjustments. I mean, the adjustments range, by state, one of which would be completely ceasing outbound in specific areas and states. We've made some internal decisions on that, states that haven't specifically requested that we cease outbound, but that we see as kind of hot spots of COVID. We've monitored that pretty closely and made some internal decisions to cease outbound on those. We've more than anything, we've adjusted our training on empathy, our talk-offs, our scripting, just reminding agents that when you do have a contact and you are having these conversations, it's very important to understand the consumer's circumstances. And when you are, when they do mention something like this, don't go immediately to, your collector kind of next step. It's have a conversation. Understand when you think they might be able to pay, or if they want to put their account on hold. Similar to what LaDonna mentioned, we have a disposition on our account that will allow our collectors to say this particular consumer has been affected by COVID-19, and it puts some controls in place that takes that account out of treatment. So while we've minimized some of our outbound campaigns, we've certainly reduced our outbound call efforts. We've also really modified how we collect when there's discussion on COVID.
Well, Alicia, you talk about, notating your accounts as to who's COVID related. That also goes back to, where we can't send letters in the first place and making sure that our software, our computer software, our collection software and our letter vendors both have suppression technology. I know that, in talking with Bobby earlier at Rentcom, they have suppression technology. So when you say, hey, make sure you send all those Nevada letters, they're going to say, whoa, their system just puts a hold on that. Same, I know at Interpros, they do the same thing where their software is able to freeze out anything when you're trying to send a letter to where you're not supposed to. That helps, especially, with younger collectors, maybe people you just hired, and, they may not have a full appreciation of where he can and can't send stuff and why he can't. And maybe they don't know, they're not keeping up on the laws because they're already so inundated with new information, all FDCPA, you know, on the bare bones basics, they are still having a hard time getting their hands around. Well, it's easy to have a letter go to where it's not supposed to go if you're not having your letter vendor and your internal software doing its best to prevent mistakes like that.
And Alicia, you made a point that made me think of something, you know, with calling strategies, and people think I'm a little weird when I say this. Well, I am a little weird, but not because of this. I always look at the web recon stats, and they always break it down. Jack always breaks it down where, you know, where the lawsuits are coming from. And I look at those states, and I have special dialing strategies for those states that are even more conservative than some of our other dialing strategies, just because I don't like to poke the bear, you know?
Well, and Lonnie, we had a question or a comment here about litigious debtor scrubbing, you know, web recon, as good as it gets. Use web recon to scrub out those litigious debtors now, because we've got so much on our plate. Lawsuits are just, you know, another thing we don't need now more than ever.
Yeah.
Let me jump back in here. A few other questions have come in. One related specifically to Wisconsin. Has anybody stopped sending letters to people in Wisconsin, or do you know if anybody has stopped sending letters to Wisconsin? Does anybody have any insights they want to share on that?
I've been asked about Wisconsin by my clients as to whether to send things. They're still sending letters. Are you still sending letters? LaDonna, Alicia, have you changed the wording of your letters?
We're not licensed in Wisconsin. So
you're definitely not sending anything.
No, so we're not.
LaDonna has no further comments on this.
Yes, thank you.
we have not stopped sending letters in Wisconsin. We have modified our outbound strategy. And we've already, like I said earlier, kind of reduced our overall outbound letter volume to adjust for, the past couple weeks. So we haven't targeted anything specific to Wisconsin, but given the quote guidance, we have reduced the amount of outbound calls we're making to Wisconsin.
Better be safe than sorry.
Another questions come in. Should alterations to the languages in disputes through the FDCPA and FCRA have any added languages, especially for the states that have ceased collections, but you have the federal requirements to respond?
Now, my understanding of that, and maybe Dennis can correct me, is if the consumer reaches out to you, you have to respond. Is that not correct?
Right, yeah. And in most of those states that have prohibitions on reaching out to consumers, they do allow for you to respond when the consumer contacts you. I think this is an excellent opportunity, though, to remind everyone that what we're giving is not legal advice. It's a general business discussion, and that anything we say can't be used against us anywhere at any time.
And you can't bill us.
Yeah, right. And then the other side of that is we don't bill you. So it's an even Steven swap.
I think it brings up another really interesting point, though. And it's this, you know, specifically relate. Let's talk about FCRA for a second and the FCRA obligations. So FCRA obligations, you get a dispute under the FCRA. You have to respond to it within 30 days. And so the CFPB came out and said, you know, basically, hey, we're not going to pursue any enforcement actions based on this. You know, we kind of understand the environment. We're going to give you a little bit of leniency. And don't quote me on that. I'm just paraphrasing there. But then there are state AGs that then came back. And I think Mike actually reported on this earlier this week, came back and said, CFPB, no, that's ridiculous. Why would you not enforce the strict statutory requirements of the FCRA? So I think, you know, while there are states that are limiting contact restrictions and saying stop collections, you still need to be mindful of your obligations under federal statutes and adhere to those, because, you know, whether or not regulators are saying they're going to pay attention right now doesn't necessarily mean that they won't 2-3 months from now when everything's calmed down.
And independent of whether regulators are going to give you 45 days, you know, the extra 15 days, plaintiff's attorneys aren't, and courts have I mean, they're going to have to go by the letter of the law. They can't go by a non-binding statement of the CFPB, which is nothing, really. And so, and one of the things that I've come across and is clients telling me that, yeah, they're still responding and they're keeping up with everything, but it's becoming harder and harder. We had a Collector Live Home Edition this week. And one of the things I was on a legal panel, we were discussing how we believe consumers and plaintiff's attorneys are going to respond to the COVID-19 crisis. And one of the things I talked about was, I think they're going to inundate us with disputes, because knowing we're all spread out, we're working from home, we're all distracted and kind of disoriented just in general, keeping up with all these disputes and responding in kind and reinvestigations and contacting our creditors and not closing accounts when we can't contact our creditors. I think that is just a big bowl of problems and potential lawsuits that's going to be coming down the road. So stay up on your disputes. I know we're talking about letters here, so we'll talk about disputes in the letter, but however you get that dispute, make sure you're staying on top of your reinvestigation and response requirements. And if you just cannot because of the barriers that you're facing, then stop reporting the account. You don't have to stop collecting on it, but you just got to stop reporting it.
That's good advice. Thank you.
Donna, I made a note that when you asked people or you asked the panel about why they send letters, we never heard from you about what the objective is when you send a letter. Is it to get people to pay? Is it to get people to call you? Why do you send letters?
To get the communication process started. You know, we'll gladly take a call in, and I think Alicia used the terminology resolve the account, because that's our goal. The client placed the account with us, and we just want to resolve it, you know, preferably through payment, but we all know that there are other ways of resolving accounts. So just to get the communication going with the consumer, because, you know, now they're, you know, they see they're with a collection agency and the letter might not motivate them to call, might be a little embarrassed, but if we can get some communication going, that's what we're hoping for.
Well said. We have a question that came in from someone. We normally don't send many letters. We're making limited outbound calls right now. During this time, we are considering sending letters to get information in front of the consumer so they could go to our website or use our IVR to make a payment. And the question is, what are your thoughts about that?
I like that strategy. You know, if the more options, and in my opinion, that you can give a consumer to resolve an account, the better. And if you've got your IVR set up, in a compliant way, you know, then there's no issues there. And same thing with the website, you know, website's not going to argue or say something incorrect. Dennis,
yeah, Alicia? Yeah. I like that. I'll tell you one thing I do want to talk about. There's been a recent string of lawsuits for out-of-stat debt, and there being no disclosures on the website, which is just so frustrating. And for those of you who are defendants in those cases, I'm sorry, I'm defending five of them right now, and it's not great. So if you're going to have things on your website, and you're going to direct people to your website, just make sure that for debt that's out of stat, make sure it's somewhere disclosed. If you're going to have the disclosures, and talk to your attorney and so on and so forth, but make sure they're there on your website. Because the bad thing about websites, right, is people from anywhere can, from any part of the country, states that may or may not, you areas of the country, you may or may not have to have these disclosures. Well, now you're going to have them potentially. And if so, how do you connect them to a certain debt? And it gets very frustrating. But keep that in mind if you're going to start directing people for payments on your website more than usual.
Now, you've brought up out-of-stat twice, and at my last gig, we did a lot of out-of-stat collections. So on the website, would you recommend that we put, for the states that don't have a requirement, that you have a special announcement to get the consumer disclosure, that we put the FTC recommended out-of-stat disclosure, and then the state-specific for the states who have the state-specific requirements?
Well, so It's pretty complicated, and fortunately, there's a hot topic on this coming up in next month, I think, early next month. And, but the reason I mention it that it's complicated is that for example, you have to disclose if you're state, like Missouri, if you pay part of the debt, it starts the clock over again. Your 10-year statute of limitation or 5-year statute of limitation starts over if you make even a $1 payment. But some states aren't like that. And so, you know, you just can't have a blanket statement on the website. You almost have to make it specific to the debt. So when somebody checks their debt, it comes up, but only directed toward that debt. Now, I've talked to Aaron Ryder about this and how difficult or easy that is, because I'm trying to formulate, you know, the defense strategy for us and to try to talk common sense to these judges. And, you know, so we're talking about that. It's a hassle. It's expensive. It's time consuming. It's difficult. And it puts an incredible barrier, burden on agencies collecting out-of-stat debt. But my larger point wasn't to try to give advice as much as to give a warning that if you are doing that, especially when I'm telling you these guys are going to look for anything they can to try to sue us, now's the time to try to formulate how do we give disclosures when we need to give disclosures. And, you know, so.
Not the answer I was looking for, but Alicia, do you remember what the original question was about, you know, using other communication sources to get the consumer's attention versus letters and phone calls? Was it IVR, website? What do y'all think about that?
Yeah, so I just kind of want to jump on the bandwagon here just real quick on the website too. You know, there was a string of litigation surrounding ADA as well. So that's something I think that you need to review and ensure that your website is in compliance. I think also on out-of-stat, you know, we, as I said, we work a lot of out-of-stat debt. We have a very complex system that considers age of debt, state, whether or not we can credit report for that client, if it's credit reportable in terms of the age, and then it pops a disclosure. So I think the point that all of us are trying to make is that if you are going to shift where you're driving your consumers, you need to make sure that your compliance is in line with that. You know, the more traffic, so to speak, that you're getting at those specific sources, the more risk you're putting towards those. So, you know, does your IVR have the appropriate disclosures, you know, in terms of possible recording or mini Miranda? Does your website have disclosures relating to ADA, or is it ADA compliant? Do you have out-of-stat disclosures? So ultimately, just ensure that, you know, if you're going to drive traffic to different areas of your company that you haven't already done or don't do previously, that you're evaluating the risk associated with driving the traffic to those areas.
Alicia, that's a great comment you make about ADA. At C100, that was a topic that was discussed. I think it was, I forget, it's Domino's or Pizza Hut or one of the, some pizza place. I mean, it's got hammered for it. And what Alicia's talking about, a case for those who don't know, people who maybe are visually impaired, how do they go about seeing, you know, finding information on your website? And so you have to be able to make sure visually impaired people have access to the same information as people who are not visually impaired. And, you know, from a tech standpoint, I don't know the answers to that, but I do know that, you know, I'm in discussions now with my IT person to get my website ADA compliant, because that, you know, the last thing I want to do is have nailed it on all my compliance issues and then get hit with some ADA, you know, thing that I never would have seen coming a few months ago. So, but again, you know, it's kind of Alicia was implying, the more you push people to your website and the more you push people to a certain type of technology, you got to make sure that technology doesn't leave itself open, doesn't leave you open to exposure.
Good points.
We've only got a couple of minutes left before we wrap up. I'll give everybody sort of one last reminder. If you have a question for our panel, this is your last and best chance to get it in. As we wait to see if any questions do get populated, I'm curious. We've talked a little bit about sort of needing regulatory approval on letters. And I had a question about clients, so I'm going to fold both of those into one question. Have you received any guidance or had any conversations with your clients or with regulators about letters? And what, if so, what's been the, you know, what's been the trend or the substance of those conversations?
This is Dennis. I haven't had any conversations, but I will say though, as far as different states and regulators and staying up to things, ACA huddle call and the ACA website where it has a special place for COVID-19 updates. ACA, I believe, is ahead of the curve when it comes to getting information, putting it together, and making it accessible to everyone in an easy way to understand. If I'm an agency owner operating at, well, I just tell you that for Missouri and Illinois, I've stayed very close. I know the law very well, but outside of those states, if I was an agency and I had to stay on top of everything, I'd be looking at the ACA website every day for changes.
Yeah, I agree with Dennis. And, you know, I haven't had any conversations with any regulators, but I do tune into, you know, the CFPB's website, any articles I see coming from the CFPB or the Federal Trade Commission, and, you know, anything Elizabeth Warren has to say about, you know, our industry and how bad we are, I try to stay on top of those things so, you know, I can jump ahead of it and evaluate what we are doing. So, and our clients, we've had a few clients who've asked us to, you know, stop the process, but then, you know, other clients, you know, we've reached out to be proactive to say, you know, we know we'll be talking to your patients. We are going to, you know, show empathy and collect with kindness and just to keep them understanding that their accounts are in good hands.
I think, LaDonna, you make a really good point about just being proactive with your clients and communicating with them on what your plans are. And I think that's the key is, you know, a lot of our clients, fortunately, trust us to make these decisions. So when it comes to them specifically mandating that we include any text in our letters or any modifications, we haven't really seen that because we're a trusted partner. We have conversations with them. So we haven't received any mandates from any of our clients to modify any letters. You know, in terms of regulators, you know, we're watching everything as LaDonna had talked about. I do know that there are, you know, individuals within the CFPB that are asking agencies right now, essentially, can your output match your input? So if you are, so it's not so much on content of letters, but it's if you aren't decreasing your volume of outbound, if you're not decreasing your volume of letters, is your staff able to keep up with the information flow that you're getting back, the disputes possibly that you're getting back, the consumers that are calling in? Are there longer than average hold times? Are there, you know, delays and, you know, particularly FCRA direct dispute responses? So it's not so much that the regulators that I know about are focusing on the content of the letters as much as it is. Is your collection strategy matching your staffing right now? And if it's not, you know, there, I think the perception is it has potential to negatively impact consumers who, you know, the agencies really need to monitor that.
Well, and Alicia and LaDonna, you talk about communication, which is always important and the center of any relationship. And we should reach out to our regulators, hopefully through, you know, channels such as your ACA state unit or maybe even coordinate with ACA regarding the best way to do it or the kind of messaging to put forward. But you know, I've got a good relationship with our AG office simply because of my involvement with the state unit. And, you know, I've been to several of his fundraisers and just to talk to him and build a relationship. So, you know, we've reached out to his office to make sure Missouri isn't going to go, you know, wacky and start putting in, you know, a bunch of rules in place. I mean, there's two strategies. One is you shut up and hope nobody thinks about it, or two, try to get ahead of conversations like, should we stop garnishments? And I think the first strategy is a little naive because, I mean, of course, all these states are thinking the same thing. They're all got the same issues on their plate. So it's better to at least try to get out and talk to the people with whom you've built relationships over the years, whether it be about letter content or letter regulations or using texting or not garnishing and to make them feel rest assured we're not coming after your stimulus checks. Please don't regulate this because it's not happening. Or if you do want to regulate it, make sure it's limited to that and not, you know, all bank levies or not all wage garnishments or whatever. But to your point of the question, Mike, and to Alicia and LaDonna's point of communication, keep regulators with whom you've built relationships into that same loop.
Well, excellent. Well, we've run out of time. Alicia, LaDonna, Dennis, thank you so much. I can tell I've been looking at some of the feedback that's been coming in and all the 5 out of 5s that you're getting and the fact that, you know, the attendance normally, there's normally a drop off over the course of an hour, but pretty much everybody who's been on it stayed on for the entire duration of this webinar. it's just a testament to your expertise and your insights. So awesome job. Thank you very much for me. Thank you very much for everybody who participated today. You guys really rocked it.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Bye. Everybody. Thanks for listening today. Stay tuned. There's more webinars in the near future. A recording of this event will be posted to the webinar recordings page of accountsrecovery.net in the next day or so. Thanks for participating, and hope everybody stays safe. Take care.
Thanks.